Welcome to the fourth episode of the IBD for Primary Care podcast series. My name is Charlie Andrews, a GP and regional clinical champion for IBD for the Royal College of General Practitioners and Crohn's and Colitis UK. I'd like to start by thanking Crohn's and Colitis UK, the largest charity in the UK for those affected by IBD, for making this series possible. This series forms part of the RCGP and Crohn's and Colitis UK's IBD Spotlight project, which aims to improve the confidence of primary care clinicians in diagnosing, managing, and referring patients with IBD. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Kevin Barrett, and we're going to be discussing flare management in primary care. IBD is a relapsing remitting condition, and around 50% of patients experience a flare of their disease each year. While some patients will go directly to the hospital team when they're experiencing a flare of symptoms, for example, those with complex disease or taking medications such as biologic agents, many will come to their GP as their first port of call. And so an understanding of when it's appropriate to start treatment and what treatment we may consider starting is really important. Kevin is an excellent person to be discussing flare management with. Kevin is both a GP partner and lead clinical champion for IBD for the Royal College of General Practitioners and Crohn's and Colitis UK. He has a wealth of knowledge in IBD care, having recently contributed to the British Society of Gastroenterology guidance on IBD management, carried out GP education all over the UK, and produced a national flare pathway for primary care with input from both primary and secondary care clinicians. This pathway can be found at the IBD Toolkit online. I'd highly recommend that you have a look at this either whilst we discuss it or in your own time afterwards. So welcome, Kevin.
Hi, Charlie.
So let's kick this off by just asking, why did a flare pathway need to be created, in your opinion?
I think there are lots of reasons for doing it. When we started the Spotlight project back in 2017, we did a survey and we asked GPs and GP trainees and patients and a whole range of people what they wanted us to do as part of the Spotlight project. And developing a flare pathway was high on that list. We know that there are absolutely fantastic pathways out there that different units have produced all around the UK, but there's not a nationally approved pathway, and there's not a pathway that's available for those areas that don't have easy access to their IBD team. And when we did the survey at the beginning, we found that about 52% of GPs lacked confidence in managing patients with IBD when they came to them with flares. And exactly as you said, lots of patients will come to see their GP when they're having a flare if they can't get hold of their IBD nurse or they don't have their own patient-held flare card. So the flare path is just a way to combine lots of national evidence using NICE guidance and BSG expertise, gastroenterologists. We came together, we organised a group meeting that had gastroenterologists, it had patients, IBD nurses, we had IBD specialist pharmacists involved as well, and we came up with the pathways. A bit of to-ing and fro-ing went on, but we finally agreed upon a pathway for one for Crohn's disease and one for ulcerative colitis. And then that got taken back to the BSG and the Primary Care Society for Gastroenterology and the Royal College of General Practitioners, and they all gave it their endorsement. So it's there to be used for those cases when patients come to see us who maybe can't get hold of that advice or don't have their own personalised care plan.
Great. And you said that there are two pathways, and I'm going to take us down one of those pathways first of all, if that's okay. So I've brought a case that's based on patients I've seen in clinic. It's not a person in particular, but is a patient that we may well see with ulcerative colitis, first of all. So let's just talk about how you'd approach this, Kevin. You've got a patient who's around 40 years old. They've got ulcerative colitis. They were diagnosed 2 years ago, and they've had no flare-ups since they were diagnosed. But they come to see you, and they found that they've been getting bleeding from their rectum about 4 to 5 times a day. It's quite loose stool. They're getting some lower abdominal griping pains. They're taking mesalazine orally 2.4 grams daily. And you read their letter in clinic. So you see their clinic letter from their gastroenterologist, and it says that they've got left-sided colitis extending from the rectum to about 20 centimeters proximally in the colon. So how would you approach this patient who's coming to see you?
Yeah, this is a very typical patient that we see in primary care. Certainly there's a lot of information there, and it can be quite overwhelming for us as GPs trying to sift through all of that too. But the key information actually is all there. when we face these patients, we don't see them very often. So it's good to have a kind of a clear management strategy when it comes to them. I think the first thing to say actually is to obviously, which we all do all the time, is to assess the patient and make sure they're not acutely unwell. So obviously if they're appear septic or hypotensive, tachycardic, they're passing lots of frequent bloody stools and they actually look unwell, then those are the patients we should be speaking to the on-call medical team about, because they're at greater risk of sepsis. So that's always the first thing we do, which when we eyeball a patient that comes and walks into the room, we automatically do anyway. I think the next step after that is to make sure the patient is suitable for the pathway. These pathways are for patients who have established uncomplicated disease. So if this patient has a previous history of having a fistula or a stoma or has had surgery or is on biologic therapy, then that group of patients really, this pathway isn't suitable for, and those patients should be under the care of their secondary care team. Once we've established that and the patient doesn't have their own patient held flare card, then it's really important to make sure this patient is having a flare, because lots of other things can happen to patients with IBD. Just the fact that the patient has ulcerative colitis doesn't mean that they can't get traveler's diarrhea, they can't get gastroenteritis, it doesn't mean they can't get colorectal cancer. So again, we have to bear those things in mind. We know that patients with ulcerative colitis, I think, have an 18% chance on average of developing colorectal cancer 30 years after diagnosis. We hear stories from time to time about patients where they've been assumed to have IBD and flares of their IBD, and the symptoms don't quite match the normal envelope of symptoms, but it's just people have ignored it and carried on down that IBD route, and it turns out that later on they've got quite advanced colorectal cancer. So again, it's just important to make sure that, you know, you're bearing all those sorts of things in mind. And then if you have got the luxury of doing near patient testing calprotectin, that's fantastic. Not many GPs have that. To send a sample for calprotectin off to the lab can take 2 weeks, and often the age is limited. This patient's 40 years old, and some areas restrict calprotectin testing to patients under 40. But we can still rely upon our standard blood tests, so full blood count, ESR, CRP, those sorts of things as well. So that'd be my first strategy when it comes to dealing with this patient.
So you're trying to risk stratify them, and you're trying to get some evidence to support that this is an IBD flare in that first stage, but being really wary of and mindful of the fact that there could be other things going on.
Yes, absolutely. I think it's very easy for us just to automatically reach for the steroids and to go straight for that no matter what. And I think steroids definitely have a place, and we'll see later on in the pathway where that place is. But it's just, we should just use our put our thinking hats on to begin with and just think, is there anything else I can do instead of that? Because we know that steroid overuse is not great for patients. It's associated with a huge range of side effects, osteoporosis, mental health issues, all the sort of things we know about as well. So it's very, very important for us not to automatically just go straight for the steroid prescription.
And the thing that I'm really excited about the pathways with is that they give really good advice about how we can use medications other than steroids initially. So for example, the topical mesalazines, etc. Could you expand on that a bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, we know that patients come out of the hospital clinics from seeing their gastroenterologists, from seeing their IBD nurses, with sometimes quite complicated regimes with steroid suppositories and mesalazine suppositories and enemas and liquid preparations to use. But there's often a very good reason for that. So the pathway splits disease into two. We did think about splitting it into more than that, but we split it into two sides. You've got proctitis, or left-sided disease, that only affects the left colon up to splenic flexure. And then on the other side of the pathway, we've got patients who has more extensive disease, maybe reaching around the transverse colon, maybe all the way around the whole of the colon, to give them a pancolitis. For the proctitis, left-sided disease, generally, again, mesalazines are the mainstay treatment, and topical treatment generally works quite well for these patients. And the pathway talks about the time to use suppositories, to use the foam enemas. Occasionally talks about using liquid enemas, depending where the disease is. And then talks about about bringing the patient back, or at least having some kind of follow-up with the patient to make sure they are responding to that treatment. whether it's a phone call or empowering the patient to get in touch with you if they're not getting any better. Mesalazines generally don't work as quickly as steroids. We'd normally expect a response within a few days, maybe a week, of giving a patient some oral steroids, whereas the mesalazines, whether they're given topically or orally, can take up to 2 weeks for patients to respond. So you don't get that immediate response, which, and that can be difficult for some patients because they do like taking the steroids because they know that within a few days they can start feeling better again. So you have to say, actually, in your case, I don't want to go down that route first of all. Your disease doesn't warrant it. There are the side effects of steroids. Can we try giving you the mesalazines instead?
So in our patient that we just talked about, who's, let's say that you've assessed them and actually they're quite well with it, they've got left-sided colitis, what would you choose to treat them with in this case?
This patient, they're already on their maintenance dose of oral mesalazine. And it's great, actually, this patient, they've been on it for 2 years, which is fantastic. And there is evidence that actually the longer patients stay on their oral mesalazines for, the less likely they are to have flares. And also, it does also reduce their chance of developing colorectal cancer as well. So it's great because often patients, they feel better, they take the mesalazine for a few months and they get bored of taking it and they stop. And obviously as GPs, we don't know when patients stop taking the medication unless they come to see us. So for this patient, what it might be worth doing is having a chat to them saying, actually, their disease is, he talked about 20 centimetres, which is, you know, quite far up. You could get away with some of the rectal preparations for him, but it may be better actually for this patient to go straight for that, to double the dose of mesalazine and go from 2.4 up to 4.8 grams per day.
So doubling up that oral dose is a good option. And do we sometimes use the doubled up dose by mouth plus the enemas and suppositories? Is it safe to do that?
Yeah, totally. Mesalazines are very safe drugs. Occasionally patients get an acute nephritis, but that tends to happen when they first start taking it as well. And as long as the patient is young and fit and has got good renal function and it's been checked on a reasonably regular basis, just maybe once a year, then actually we can be fairly confident at increasing the dose. And that's the standard dose that the BNF says is to go from 2.4 to 4.8 grams. Obviously, it slightly depends upon the exact preparation they're on. And you can combine that with the topical rectal preparations as well. And it's perfectly safe to do both. And some patients do need both to actually get their disease under control.
And if we see him again in clinic and we find that his symptoms, let's say that they have improved and actually he feels that he's going back into remission, do we continue with that heightened treatment for a period of time or can we just reduce it immediately?
Again, the guidance, the pathway we have says that patients, once they feel back to normal again as well, they should probably stay on that maximum dose for maybe 6 or 8 weeks before they go back to the maintenance dose as well. There's no hard or fast rules about that, and it does sort of depend upon the patient, but I would normally say about 6 weeks of being on that higher dose, probably 8 weeks in reality, and then make sure they go back down to that maintenance dose and carry on that maintenance dose. Again, the BSG guidance didn't find any strong evidence about whether it should be 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years of taking the maintenance dose. But the consensus was that if patients are on it and they're tolerating it and their kidneys are in a good condition, then it's probably best for them to stay on it for the long term.
Okay. And if this patient were not responding as we'd want them to, but they still weren't requiring, for example, to be sent to hospital to be assessed more, where would you go next?
Yeah, I think that this patient, and we know there are lots of patients that don't respond to mesalazines, particularly when having a flare. And for those patients, I think that's when the steroids come into play. And the general advice is to use prednisolone in these patients. You can use budesonide for the sort of the left side of the disease. Again, there are some prescribing restrictions on it, and it's a drug that some of us are familiar with, some GPs aren't, some gastroenterologists like it, and there's definitely a place for it, but you have to make sure that when you prescribe it, you prescribe the right preparation, because the budesonide generally comes as preparations that have got different coatings, different release bits, they're designed to release in different parts of the bowel as well. So when we prescribe it, we have to make sure that we actually use the right preparation and don't just write down budesonide and then send that one off, because the chemist won't know which version you're after, and the patient might get one that releases in the wrong part of the bowel. But for most of us, you know, in primary care, we just go straight for the prednisolone. But it's important that we give patients a proper dose of steroids for a decent length of time. We know it's very easy for us in primary care just to dish out 30 milligrams for a week and the patient feels a bit better. But those sorts of doses that we use for exacerbations of asthma and COPD, they don't generally work for patients with IBD. And if we are going to give oral steroids, we need to give a decent course for a decent length of time. So the standard regime that we'd use is to give 40 milligrams for a week, then 35 for a week, then 30 for a week, and then cut down by 5 milligrams per week over 8 weeks until they've stopped. And that gives you a total of 252 tablets. And again, if we're going to prescribe steroids for a flare of IBD, it's important that we actually give the patient enough steroids to last them, but not too many. It's very tempting to give 300 or 400 tablets because it just makes prescribing easy. But then patients can then go and stockpile them and use them and eke them out and just, you know, have a few in the cupboard just for emergencies, or pop round to granny's house and borrow her rescue pack for her COPD and use them as well. But it's really important that if we are using steroids, that actually we tell the patient that there's a particular way they need to be used. And that also that we let secondary care know when we're using steroids, because the general advice is that if a patient has to have more than two courses of steroids in 12 months, or they can't get below 10 milligrams of prednisolone or 3 milligrams of budesonide, whichever one we choose to go for, or they have a flare-up again within 6 weeks of stopping, that actually their maintenance therapy, so in this case his mesalazine, may not be the right treatment for him, and he might need to have that treatment escalated.
And I think that's really important, isn't it, to know when further escalation of treatment is needed. So that's helpful to cover. So let's go to a patient with Crohn's disease, if that's all right. Let's take our patient, again, a fictional patient, but we got a patient in their 30s, diagnosed with Crohn's disease about 7 years ago. It's not really caused them any problems at all over that time. But they come in to see you with diarrhea. They're quite fatigued and they're getting some abdominal pain as well. They haven't noticed much blood, but there is some mucus in their stool, and they were told to look out for those sorts of things. And they're not on any medications at all for this. How would you approach this one, Kevin?
Crohn's disease can be a lot trickier than ulcerative colitis. Again, there's a broader spectrum of disease with it as well. Because ulcerative colitis generally only affects the inner wall of the bowel, whereas Crohn's disease can affect all through the bowel, and you're much more likely to get fistulas, you can get abscesses formed. It's generally a messier disease than ulcerative colitis. On the whole, it can be much, much harder for us to manage that in primary care. So generally, the patient with Crohn's disease, I would have a much lower threshold for seeking advice from secondary care. Clearly do that with ulcerative colitis, but certainly with Crohn's, I'd be much, much more wary about starting treatment in primary care without getting hold of that advice. And I think that's reflected in what the pathway says, because of those risks of abscesses and fistulas and much more complicated disease. However, if you've got no choice and you can't get hold of anybody and the patient doesn't know what to do in terms of they haven't got their own flare card and they haven't got any previous history with the patient, and the disease, the symptoms the patient has got are the same as their usual symptoms, then generally with Crohn's disease, then steroids are your mainstay, because we know that mesalazines very rarely work, and that's become clear in the guidance over the last 10 or 15 years. And again, it's just making sure that if you're going to treat them with steroids, that again, we use an appropriate dose for an appropriate length of time. And the dosing regime is actually identical for that for ulcerative colitis. So again, you start with 40 milligrams for a week, 40 milligrams per day for a week, then 35 milligrams per day for a week, and then cut down until you stop. And the same with budesonide. But again, with budesonide, the preparation is slightly different in Crohn's than they are for ulcerative colitis. So again, it's just making sure that we check we're using the right preparation of budesonide, because again, they're all designed to be released at different parts in the bowel as well. So don't just do generic budesonide. Have a check and then see which preparation you actually need to use. And that information is there on the pathways.
Yeah, the pathway is really helpful. It shows that with perianal disease, there's one treatment side, and then it's got the terminal ileal Crohn's and then the colonic involvement. So I think it is really clear, isn't it? And gives you good advice about which steroid preparation might be most appropriate, which is really helpful. In terms of steroids, obviously avoiding overuse is really important. Do you have any key messages that you can give to GPs around this? You've given lots of really helpful things, such as the number of tablets to give and when to escalate their care. Do you have any other key messages that you could give us on that?
I think the key thing is just to make sure that you know what you're treating. If you are going to treat it, you treat it properly. You know, you go for a decent dose, but you cut it down quite rapidly, so you do that weekly reduction. And the other thing I think it's important to talk about is bone protection, something that is often overlooked or forgotten about with steroid prescribing. So if you're giving patients 8 weeks worth of oral steroids, again, we need to think about their bones, because patients with Crohn's disease in particular are at greater risk of osteoporosis because of the malabsorption that can occur in the small bowel, because of the inflammatory process itself, because they restrict their diet, because they know that for some patients, dairy products that act as a FODMAP and give them pain and bloating, and they generally avoid eating dairy products. And again, also the effect that steroids have on their bones. So the BSG is in their guidance that's published in September have come up as a very clear, well, as clear as it can be, a pathway for assessing patients to make sure that you are looking after their bones. And the consensus was that actually every patient that you're giving that length of treatment for steroids should make sure they have an adequate intake of calcium and vitamin D. And if you're unsure that they do in terms of the dietary input, then just co-prescribe a calcium and vitamin D supplement with it as well. And then also for those patients who are at greater risk or have already known to have osteopenia or osteoporosis, then to do a FRAX assessment or a DEXA scan according to their need. And then add a bisphosphonate where it's appropriate to do so. So I think bones are important with Crohn's for all sorts of reasons.
That's really helpful, Kevin. Thank you. Do you have anything else that you would like to share around flare management?
I think it's also worth talking to the patients about things that they feel might trigger off their flares. Now, that's slightly controversial subject because we know there's no known actual trigger that sets off the inflammatory process. Lots of patients with IBD get irritable bowel syndrome type symptoms with it as well. And there can be an overlap between the symptoms that you get with an inflammatory flare of IBD versus a symptomatic flare with the IBS type symptoms as well. And it's quite important to kind of differentiate between the two, because patients can still get diarrhea and bloating and fatigue and abdominal pain and other bits and pieces with the IBS type symptoms that are highly associated with IBD. So again, it's just making sure we don't automatically leap and assume it is an inflammatory flare and then over-treat our patients, particularly with steroids. But again, it's really important that we don't under-treat them either as well, because we know that once flares get established and once patients end up down that line, if they're not treated appropriately at the beginning, they're much more likely to have to end up in hospital and end up having surgery and intravenous steroids and all those sorts of things. So it's a fine line to tread. But I think the key thing for us as GPs is to listen to our patients, and for them, you know, because patients with IBD often know their disease pretty well, and they can usually tell the difference between a symptomatic flare versus an inflammatory flare.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point to end on, isn't it? Is that patients with IBD do get to know their disease very well, don't they? So Kevin, thank you so much for talking to me today. Just to finish, I just wanted to say flares of IBD, they are common, and prompt recognition and treatment not only significantly improves patients' quality of life, but it reduces adverse outcomes such as Kevin said, hospitalisation and surgical treatments. I also find it really rewarding actually as a clinician to manage flares in these patients. And I hope that, like me, you'll find the flare pathways really easy to follow and relevant to primary care. So thank you very much for listening. Further information on all aspects of IBD management, including the flare pathways, can be found on the RCGP's IBD Toolkit online.